government shutdown. The Trump administration talks of taking the opportunity to fire federal workers. Democrats call it blackmail, but what would they do about it? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our Pentagon correspondent says he's never heard of a meeting like the one scheduled in Virginia. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth ordered officers from around the world to one location and has yet to say why. Also, what are the terms of a deal to transfer control of TikTok from Chinese hands to mostly American ones? We'll say what we know. It's Friday, September 26th, the birthday of John Chapman back in 1774. He planted apple trees from Pennsylvania to Illinois. You might know him as Johnny Appleseed. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A federal grand jury in Virginia has indicted former FBI Director James Comey on two criminal counts. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports Comey faces obstruction of justice and false statement counts.
The charges against Jim Comey come after days of pressure from President Trump, who urged the Justice Department to hurry up and build a criminal case against him. The statute of limitations had been set to expire next week. The charges stem from Senate testimony Comey gave in September 2020 about the FBI investigation into Russian election interference and a leak to the news media. The White House recently forced out a longtime prosecutor after he cast doubt on the strength of any case against Comey. This week, Lindsay Halligan, an insurance lawyer with no experience as a prosecutor, but who had earlier ties to Trump, became U.S. attorney in Virginia. The president posted, quote, "Justice in America," after the indictment became public. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to speak at the United Nations General Assembly this morning. Earlier this month, the UN commission declared that he and other Israeli officials are responsible for inciting genocide in Gaza. NPR's Emily Fang reports Netanyahu's speech will be broadcast in Gaza.
NPR confirmed that Israel's military is preparing to blast Netanyahu's speech on loudspeakers in Gaza, where Israel has just started a new ground offensive. On his flight to New York, Netanyahu took a slight detour to avoid much of European airspace because he also faces an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court for alleged war crimes. Now Netanyahu is set to walk into the UN headquarters and deliver a speech that Israeli media says will lambast Western countries which have recognized Palestinian statehood in recent days. Emily Fang, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President Trump says he will not allow Israel to annex the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Trump would not say whether he had discussed this issue with Prime Minister Netanyahu, although Trump did say the two spoke yesterday. Trump and Netanyahu are supposed to meet on Monday. The Defense Department says it is summoning hundreds of U.S. military generals and admirals to meet in suburban Virginia next week. No information has been provided about this meeting. The agency says only that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth will be addressing his senior military leaders. NPR's Tom Bowman says this will be an operational challenge and could create issues for U.S. national security.
I've never heard of anything on this scale. At times they'll bring in, let's say, combatant commanders, those who oversee military operations around the world, bring them to the Pentagon for annual meetings, but this is far different in the numbers. Now, Secretary Hegseth has talked about reducing the number of admirals and generals who stand at more than 800.
NPR's Tom Bowman reporting. You're listening to NPR. President Trump says he'll impose a raft of new tariffs next week. That includes a 100% tariff on pharmaceuticals that are not made in the U.S. Trump says the only exception for pharmaceutical makers is if they're building a plant in the U.S. Last night in Dallas, several advocacy groups held a vigil for the victims of this week's shooting at a local Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility. Organizers are calling for ICE reforms after one detainee was killed in the attack and two others hospitalized. From member station KERA, Dylan Duke has more.
The vigil took place outside the hospital where organizers believe one of the victims is being treated. Tony Rodriguez is an organizer for the vigil. He said the focus should be on the victims.
The truth is that we want the story to be told about the people being hurt. This story is not about ICE being attacked. It's about our community being attacked.
He said ICE should be more transparent and give information about who the victims are. Federal investigators say the suspected shooter planned the attack for months and was targeting ICE officers. The shooting came just a month after a bomb threat was made at the same field office. For NPR News, I'm Dylan Duke in Dallas.
Forecasters say Tropical Storm Umberto is now a hurricane in the Atlantic Ocean. It developed very rapidly this week. Umberto is expected to become a major hurricane this weekend, with winds of more than 111 miles per hour. The Philippines is getting its second typhoon in a week. Typhoon Buloy is hitting the country only days after Typhoon Ragasa killed at least 25 people in the Philippines and Taiwan. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics with Eleanor the Great, a film directed by Scarlett Johansson, starring June Squibb as a 94-year-old woman who tells a tale that begins to take on a life of its own, now playing in theaters.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
September 1887, notices went out that Edwin Booth would be appearing at Duluth's Grand Opera House. He and fellow actor Lawrence Barrett would be performing favorite scenes from Shakespeare. But who was even thinking of Shakespeare?
God, God, how weary.
Because this was that Booth.
And unprofitable seem to
the older brother of John Wilkes Booth, who a mere 22 years before had assassinated Abraham Lincoln at another theater, Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. Before the assassination, Edwin had been the most famous member in the Booth family of actors, but after, he became the brother of a president killer. Edwin had had to fight to get John Wilkes' body stored in a warehouse, returned to him in 1869, so he could bury him in an unmarked grave and get on with his own life again, running a theater company, and now in 1887, undertaking a multi-city theatrical tour. Duluth's audiences may have turned up out of curiosity, but they left with an appreciation for one of the era's greatest Shakespearean actors.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. The United States Justice Department has obeyed the demand of President Trump, turning the law enforcement system against a political opponent.
A prosecutor handpicked for the task obtained an indictment of former FBI Director James Comey. She did that job after the previous prosecutor, also chosen by the president, found insufficient evidence to indict Comey for allegedly lying to Congress. So Trump changed personnel and publicly urged Attorney General Pam Bondi to act. Now, the allegation against Comey concerned a media leak about the investigation of Russia's interference in the 2016 election. Comey told a Senate committee that he had not authorized leaks, while the indictment claims he did. A bipartisan Senate committee, by the way, did find Russia did interfere in the 2016 election, but Trump has spent years claiming the investigation was a conspiracy against him. He fired Comey in 2017 when the FBI director did not drop the investigation, and Trump has talked about Comey ever since. Here's Comey on Morning Edition in May.
I seem to be the relationship that Donald Trump just can't get over. I mean, I've been gone from the FBI job for more than 8 years. But he still wakes up some nights, I guess, with pain in his chest that I'm gone.
We've called up Ryan Goodman about this. He's a legal scholar at NYU who served as a Pentagon counsel in the Obama administration. So, Ryan, what do you think of the charges?
So the charges seem fairly weak on their face. They're very unusual in that it's a very thin indictment of just a page and a half. And if the charges are indeed about Mr. Comey's exchange with Senator Cruz on the matter of whether or not Comey authorized Andy McCabe's deputy to make leaks or disclosures to the media, then there's a deep problem for the Justice Department. And it's because McCabe himself did not ever say that Comey had pre-authorized those disclosures. And it would be consistent with all the reporting that the prior U.S. attorney, Mr. Siebert, was not willing to bring the case.
So, right, if the charges, as you described them, are weak, how do you think the government will go about trying to prove them?
It's difficult to say because the government According to all the reporting, the prosecutors themselves actually thought that there was not enough evidence to charge, which is remarkable, meaning that they didn't even think there was enough evidence for probable cause. Let's say that's like a 20% likelihood that he committed the crime. Not that they didn't even think there was enough evidence for proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's the big question. And the other part would be, whoever is the unidentified person that did provide the information to the media, if that is Mr. McCabe, you would think that the government would have to rely on his testimony, or whoever that person is. And that's critical to the government's case.
Yeah, and McCabe would probably not admit to that, I would imagine.
That's right, and it's also the oddest witness possible, because in the first Trump administration under Attorney General Bill Barr, they did try to indict Mr. McCabe for the opposite, for the idea that Mr. Comey was telling the truth and Mr. McCabe lacked candor or was not, and they failed to get an indictment on that ground.
So Comey posted a response on Instagram. Let's hear part of it.
My heart is broken for the Department of Justice, but I have great confidence in the federal judicial system, and I'm innocent. So let's have a trial.
All right, so pretty unusual for a criminal defendant to make a public statement like that, and also to be as bold as to say, let's have a trial. So what did you make of his response?
I did think it was a forceful response, and the ways in which he worded that make me think that he might, in fact, ask for a very fast trial. He could put this on a fast track, and that would put the government on its back heels, potentially. Because it would mean that whatever they're prepared to present, they'd have to come to court with it very quickly.
Let's say James Comey's defense is based at least a little bit on Trump's public statements about him. Could that apply, that defense apply to people such as New York Attorney General Letitia James?
Yes, absolutely. I do think we have every reason to believe that Mr. Comey and Letitia James, if she were indicted, would bring a claim of vindictive or selective prosecution. And that is a very hard case to ever make against the Justice Department. But there's ample evidence here, given the President of the United States has been calling for Mr. Comey to be criminally investigated or criminally indicted all the way back to 2017, and as recently as last weekend, saying that he wanted his attorney general to bring the charges, which is just really remarkable, and obviously he's got a grudge.
Yeah. And really quick, last thing. Mentioned Comey said he has great confidence in the federal judicial system. Do you?
I do think so. My view is that the federal judicial system has been holding up. Judges have been very skeptical of the Justice Department when the Justice Department has not been abiding by the regular ways in which it's supposed to behave. And so the judicial system is set up for this kind of test.
Okay. Law professor and former Pentagon counsel Ryan Goodman, thank you.
Thank you.
We are 4 days away from a government shutdown.
And a memo from the White House promises to punish federal workers if that happens. The Trump administration is threatening large-scale layoffs if Democrats don't provide the necessary votes to avoid a shutdown. We don't know exactly which jobs would be targeted or how many federal workers could lose their jobs, but the deadline to come up with a solution is fast approaching.
And NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt will be covering whatever happens. Barbara, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Okay, so this is kind of a departure from the normal shutdown scenario where the government says we're going to increase the pain. What prompted this?
Well, there's a line in the memo that I think is telling here, essentially saying we're hopeful that Democrats in Congress don't trigger a shutdown, and then this won't be necessary. So I think this is partly aimed at making any funding lapse as difficult as possible for Democrats. Normally in a shutdown, you know, agencies furlough federal workers temporarily until a deal is brokered and a stopgap funding bill is passed. This is next level. It's instructing agencies to look for workers to fire permanently, people whose work is not consistent with the president's priorities.
How are Democrats responding?
Well, they view it as an intimidation tactic to get them to accept the continuing resolution that House Republicans passed that would fund the government through November 21st. I spoke with Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat, about this yesterday. Here's what he had to say.
This is nothing less than mafia-style blackmail. Essentially, the president is threatening to fire dedicated federal employees who have nothing to do with the ongoing political and policy dispute.
Meanwhile, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says that if these firings do go forward, he suspects they'll eventually be overturned in court.
Although we've learned when the president fires someone, even if a court finds illegality, it's difficult to reverse the firing, so we'll see. Is anybody talking about getting a deal out of this?
Well, top congressional Democrats were supposed to meet with President Trump yesterday at the White House, but the president canceled that meeting, saying it would be pointless to meet because Democrats, in his view, are making unreasonable demands.
Which are what?
Well, Democrats want to roll back some Medicaid changes that were part of the big tax and spending bill that the president signed earlier this summer. And they want to extend tax credits from the Affordable Care Act that are set to expire at the end of the year. House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries has said a verbal agreement that comes in any sort of negotiation isn't enough. Democrats want to address these issues in written legislation. Here he is yesterday.
We're able to sit down anytime, any place with anyone. Not hard to find. I'm here in the Capitol, willing to go to the White House at any time in order to have that conversation.
But you know, Steve, yes, this is about the shutdown. It's a very real possibility, and it would have very real consequences for people who rely on certain services and workers who might find themselves without a job permanently. But this is also about an ongoing conflict between the White House and Democrats in Congress, who feel the administration has continued to overreach in its authority and diminish the legislative branch's power of the purse. So, yes, this memo is unprecedented, but it also very much follows the administration's philosophy that we've seen play out again and again this year.
Well, Barbara, I hope you're ready for a busy few days here.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Steve.
NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt.
When world leaders gather at the United Nations, as they have this week, it's also a chance for activists to try and champion their causes. NPR's Michelle Kellerman caught up with an opposition leader from Belarus whose husband was recently released from prison.
Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is trying to get the UN to focus on her former Soviet Republic, which borders Ukraine. We speak in the General Assembly entrance under a life-size model of a Soviet Sputnik satellite.
Belarus is like communism with taste of cappuccino.
She says the country's longtime ruler, Alexander Lukashenko, presents himself as a modern leader, but rules like Stalin, jailing opponents like her husband, Sergei. He was released in June after the Trump administration sent a delegation to Minsk.
I'm so grateful that among, I suppose, thousands of different folders on the table of President Trump, there is a folder with political prisoners of Belarus.
She says Lukashenko wants recognition, but she thinks Trump can use his leverage to get more prisoners, including a human rights defender, out.
Alice Belyatsky is our Nobel Peace Prize winner, and I think that if President Trump succeeds in releasing him and other people, so Alice Belyatsky can nominate President Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize award as well.
Tikhanovskaya does have some words of caution for the Trump administration. The U.S. has tried before to lure Lukashenko away from the Kremlin's orbit, and the leader of Belarus has said he wants to strike a deal with Trump. But she says he has a symbiotic relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
And of course, we explained this to the administration of President Trump that Lukashenko is a lame duck. His time is outgoing. He's dragging our country, you know, closer to Russia, while Belarusian nation wants to be part of Western free world, you know, and we have to listen to people, not one crazy dictator who is governing for 30 years already.
She says President Trump has so far only used carrots with Lukashenko, but could pressure him not only to release more prisoners, but also to let them stay in Belarus rather than forcing them into exile like Tikhanovskaya and her husband. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the United Nations.
This is NPR News.
WEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station, an extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
R comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. From CFP, certified financial planner professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President Trump gave his blessing yesterday to a deal putting Chinese-owned TikTok in American hands, mostly. The president signed an executive order. He asserts that the deal complies with a law passed last year that threatened to ban TikTok over national security concerns. That deal had required TikTok to be sold or shut down last January. NPR's John Ruich is covering what happened instead. Hi there, John.
Good morning.
We already heard about some kind of framework for this deal, so what new are you learning here?
This executive order declares that the deal meets the standards required by Congress, which passed that law, that the app is no longer controlled by what they call a foreign adversary. The law last year said it was basically too big of a risk for TikTok to be in Chinese hands and that the app would have to be shut down, as you said, unless ByteDance, which was the parent company of TikTok, divested. The concern, of course, was that the Chinese government could somehow get data on Americans from ByteDance or use the app to influence Americans. President Trump issued a series of executive orders pausing enforcement of the ban. Some experts had said that that was legally questionable, that the law did not allow for so many extensions. But he's got a deal now, apparently, which sets up a new U.S. joint venture to run TikTok here in America, licensing the algorithm from ByteDance and operating it independently. ByteDance's share in the company will shrink to less than 20%.
Oh, so they're still involved. So does this meet the national security concerns?
Well, the deal hasn't been finalized, right? The order gives the parties another 4 months to work it out, and regulators in both countries still have to sign off. Based on what we know, though, analysts say it does seem to move in that direction. You know, on the data security front, Oracle, which is involved, had already been hosting TikTok user data on its cloud. The order says Oracle will review, monitor, and secure U.S. data flowing through TikTok. In terms of the question of whether or not China can use TikTok for influence operations, analysts say having U.S. entities in control of the algorithm probably helps there, too.
Why don't you explain the importance of the algorithm?
Yeah, so this is TikTok's content recommendation algorithm or system. It's often called TikTok's secret sauce. It's why the app is so popular. And broadly speaking, it's this sort of complex computer system that ranks videos, engages user preferences, and decides what videos are going to pop up when you scroll on TikTok. Noah John Syracuse is a professor of math at Bentley University, and he said one of the things he's been waiting to hear is what exactly the U.S. side is going to be getting in this deal. What algorithm means here, basically? Is it the source code? Is it also the AI system that helps serve up the videos that you might like?
You know, it's like you order pizza in a restaurant. You don't know if you're getting a slice of pizza or the whole pie. Like, that matters.
It matters. He says the executive order seems to suggest that this is the whole pie.
What other questions remain?
Well, experts I talked to thought that this executive order left it a little unclear who was going to be updating the algorithm. Is it Oracle? Is it ByteDance? Is it someone else? There's a potential risk there. We haven't heard a ton from the Chinese side yet, the government or ByteDance. It's unclear why. And there's also questions about whether or not the user experience is going to change now for Americans. I mean, it sounds like it's not going to be a walled-off version of the app. Americans are still going to be able to see foreign content. But going forward, the new version is going to be trained only on U.S. data, which suggests that in the future, U.S. users are only going to see what's popular among Americans rather than the broader world.
NPR's John Ruich in Silicon Valley. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Time again for StoryCorps. In the 90s, Steve and Patty Erickson kept an eye on their 11-year-old neighbor, Hannah Mitchell, whose mother had schizophrenia. Mitchell is now an adult. She spoke with the Erickson's at StoryCorps.
We knew that there were issues with your mom, and we were more than happy to always have you over to try to give you a little break from that.
I remember it was nice to see how a normal family acted with each other.
It was sometime in October, and the weather had turned cool. I looked out the window, and I saw your mom. You were following after her toward the bus stop, and you looked like you had on every article of clothing you could possibly wear, and your mom was carrying a bag, and I thought, they're leaving. I was really worried about you, and I ran outside, and it was like you'd walked off the planet. And I told Steve, I don't think they're coming back. After that, we saw the landlord, and he said, I'm evicting them. And so when they started putting out boxes at the curb, we started going through and we pulled out your schoolwork.
Some school photos.
One of your baby's shoes. I mean, it was just all sorts of random stuff, but it was all the stuff that
would mean something.
Means something to someone.
So I don't actually remember leaving. I do remember being at the Greyhound bus station, and we went from motel to motel until one day I thought, I have to get help. I'm not in school. I'm not getting fed. I think I need to go to the police. And so they put me into a foster home.
We kept your things in the garage for 20 years. Every time we went through those boxes and moved them aside, every time it's like, should we get rid of these? No, one of these days we're going to find her.
Just about a year ago, I was thinking about you again. And so I started searching on Facebook.
The elementary school that I went to was Lydaho Elementary. I posted on that page and I said, hey, does anybody have any school photos from these years? I have four kids. I desperately wanted to see if my kids looked like me in any capacity because I feel like they all look like my husband.
I found that note of someone from Lydaho looking for photos.
And there it was. I got that message in church. And I looked at my husband. I started crying. What person saves things for that long for someone else?
Yeah, two old crazy people.
I'd never thought I'd see anything of my past ever again. Pictures of myself, baby items. Just childhood. It's back. P.S. My son looks just like me.
We did think of you multiple times a year for years. It was good to be able to find you and to become such a strong, confident woman.
We couldn't be prouder of you than if we were your own parents.
Thank you.
Hannah Mitchell with Steve and Patty Erickson in Dallas, Texas. Their conversation is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. And from Dignity Memorial, for many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
A federal judge has ruled that some of the Trump administration's firings of federal employees were not lawful.
It's very validating to see a legal order that really reflects the illegality of our experience.
But the chances of getting their jobs back are slimmer than ever. That story on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock this afternoon here on People Powered KAXC. Your local host will be Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 529. Thanks for listening to the Friday morning show. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a few moments, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date, September 26. Sunny today with temperatures in the upper 60s to mid 70s. Winds from the southeast 5 to 10, gusting higher. Our lows overnight 50 to 55. And tomorrow, sunny with highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. Looking ahead to Sunday, another beautiful day, sunny highs in the mid 70s. Kootaska Community Action in Grand Rapids is collecting gently used kids' Halloween costumes now until October 15th. Costumes may be dropped off at the former Murphy Elementary building from 9 to 4 on weekdays. And Adventures in Lifelong Learning continues its fall season every Tuesday at 10 a.m. at the Bemidji Eagles Club. Coffee and treats are served beginning at 9:40. There will be a variety of speakers each week. Find a full schedule on Facebook. Look for Bemidji Adventures in Lifelong Learning. This weekend on Stay Human, you can hear live storytelling from last week's Authentic Voice event. Lauren Neamey takes his life in his hands, Teresa Alto goes to the county jail, and Michael Goldberg almost makes it to the fabulous island of Crete. Story and song for Spirit and Courage, Saturday morning at 9, Sunday at 5 p.m. The Brainerd Lakes Area Walk to End Alzheimer's is tomorrow at Forest View Middle School in Baxter. Registration begins at 9 a.m. and a ceremony and walk at 10 o'clock. Fire in the Village has a Miigwech Minnomin celebration and feast tomorrow from 2 to 5 at the Ball Club Powwow Grounds. Enjoy food, art, and sharing wild rice stories. Thanks for listening to KAXE. Here is John Latimer.
On today's date, the 26th of September in 2007, I spot a mourning cloak flying around. Mourning cloak butterflies are the first butterflies that we see in the spring. They are large, monarch-sized butterflies with dark, dark brown, almost black-looking wings, and the wings have a kind of a cream-colored border all the way around, both fore and hind wing. And if you get close enough, you'll see some lovely blue spots on the trailing wings. The mourning cloak has two generations each year. So there's one that emerges in the spring, and we see that one, and then it lays its eggs. And for the most part, summer is without the mourning cloak butterfly. And then in the fall, those butterflies that were laid as eggs in the spring hatch out from their chrysalis, and they become the mourning cloaks that we see in the fall. And so that mourning cloak butterfly that I saw this morning is going to be flying again next spring on a day in late March or early April when the temperature climbs above 50 and it's a nice sunny day.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from AG1, introducing AGZ, a nightly drink designed to support the body's natural sleep cycle with herbs, adaptogens, and minerals. More at drinkagz.com. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. It is very rare for the Pentagon to summon its top commanders from around the world into one room.
But that's what's happening next week. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth ordered the gathering in Virginia, but the Pentagon is not saying why or what he plans to announce.
NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman is covering this, of course. Tom, good morning.
Hey, Steve.
How much do you know?
Well, again, not too much. We're talking hundreds of generals and admirals who will meet on Tuesday at Marine Base Quantico, just outside Washington. The Washington Post was the first to report on this meeting. In a statement, Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell said, quote, "The Secretary of War will be addressing his senior military leaders early next week." And he was using the term Secretary of War, which both President Trump and Defense Secretary Hegseth prefer instead of Defense Secretary.
Have you heard of a meeting like this ever in your decades covering the Pentagon?
No, absolutely not. This is, on this scale, never. At times, you know, they'll bring in combatant commanders, those who oversee military operations around the world, bring them to the Pentagon for annual meetings, but this is far different in the numbers. Now, Secretary Hegseth has talked about reducing the number of admirals and generals who stand at more than 800, reducing that number by 20%. And he talked about that during his confirmation hearing and also put out a video statement back in May, once again referring to this. Let's listen.
We're back with more DOD reforms. This one is General and Flag Officer Reductions. That's the official title. My title is Less Generals, More GIs. It's a historic one, and it's in keeping with President Trump's commitment to achieving peace through strength. We're going to shift resources from bloated headquarters elements to our warfighters.
So again, Steve, that could be the reason for this meeting. Again, we just don't know for sure.
And I guess as you try to figure out what's going on, covering this as a citizen for your fellow citizens, you have to deal with a new Pentagon media policy. What is it?
Well, it says reporters must pledge not to report on classified or even unclassified material until something is released by the Pentagon. And if you don't agree to this, you'll lose your press pass. And you can't report from the Pentagon. But get this, also, you'll be barred from any U.S. military base around the world. Well, as you know, Steve, our job is not to be stenographers. The Pentagon has public affairs people and service members who write news stories. What we do is find out what's going on behind the scenes. What are the policies? Are they working? What weapons are you buying? Are you wasting money involved in illegal activity? Our job is to be watchdogs for government.
Yeah, not in a formal position, except that you're a citizen. So you're supposed to act as a citizen and find out what's going on. How do those rules affect reporting?
Well, there was a time you could roam around the Pentagon, maybe run into admirals or generals and get a better sense of what's going on. I remember after Baghdad fell during the Iraq War, Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld talked about this success in a briefing. I was walking down the hall right after that and ran into this Army officer I know. And I said, "Hey, good news, right?" He said, "No, Tom, this is not a success. Saddam Hussein's supporters are hitting our supply lines. We have to send troops back to protect them because we never sent enough troops in." That was the decision by Rumsfeld. That was an important development. Now, Steve, I'm not allowed to walk down that hallway.
The kind of information the government no longer wants us to know. Tom, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
NPR's Tom Bowman.
For more on this meeting of military leaders in Virginia next week, we've called up Sabrina Singh. She served as the deputy press secretary at the Department of Defense under Secretary Lloyd Austin. Singh is now a partner with a D.C.-based communications firm, Seven Letter, and also a CNN contributor. So, Sabrina, we just heard our Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman say he's never heard of a meeting at this scale. So what did you think of this meeting when you first heard about it?
I think he's exactly right. I've never heard of a meeting at this scale happen so quickly. I think it's important to note that four-star general and flag officers, either who lead the services or the combatant commands, come into Washington, D.C. once or twice a year to meet with the secretary and the president. And these officers, I mean, they are stationed in places like the Indo-Pacific and the Middle East, places where are pretty hot, for lack of a better word. There's a lot of activity going on. And so to pull these general and flag officers into Washington, D.C., and then they also travel with their aides, you're looking at probably upwards of 1,000 people about to descend into Virginia for a meeting that no one knows what it's about. So it's very concerning.
Yeah, what's most concerning? Is it the size of the meeting or how quickly this is being organized?
If I could say, it's a little bit of both. Our military is great because we are very structured and follow order. And so this injects disorder and chaos into a very rigid system. And that's not something that our military responds to well. So it's the size, and then it's also just the unprecedented nature of doing this so quickly without any type of agenda, really. I think it's really rattling a lot of people that I've spoken to at the Pentagon, because they like to prepare for these meetings, and yet they don't know what they should be preparing for.
Yeah, and you mentioned how some of these people are coming from areas in the world that are very, very hot. So, I mean, what does the Pentagon do to kind of mitigate that in case, you know, someone decides to take advantage?
Well, you know, if I'm China right now and I'm seeing some of this reporting that's coming out, I'm thinking probably this is an excellent time to test my power a bit. I think that's what's so concerning here, is it sends an incredibly shaky message to our adversaries around the world, and also our allies. I think you raise an interesting point. It's, you know, you're pulling these combatant commanders and their deputy combatant commanders out of their regions. Who is in charge? If something were to happen, who is in charge in their theaters? And so this sort of speaks to, I think, how out of depth someone like Secretary Hegseth is for calling a meeting like this, when meetings like this, if you want to call up your general and flag officers all around the world, there is a very easy way to do it. There are video conferences that are secure, that can be done from any place in the world. And the secretary has all of these at his disposal from his office.
And this follows Secretary Hegseth's demand that Pentagon reporters sign a pledge not to report any information that hasn't been released by the government. Sabrina, you work with the press in your time at the Pentagon. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it was incredibly disheartening, and I think it really flies in the face of a free press. That's not going to make for good reporting, and I can't imagine that any reporter or outlet would sign it, because it's because of the deep reporting and deep sourcing that you had some of the stories exposed to the public when it came to Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, to today, where you have the Department of Defense taking action against, so-called cartel boats leaving from Venezuela. That wasn't something that the administration had disclosed. That came from the press reporting it. So it's going to be incredibly damaging, I think, in the long term, and frankly, a real detriment for Pete Hegseth, because I do think it's going to backfire for him.
Sabrina Singh served as a deputy press secretary at the Department of Defense in the Biden administration. Sabrina, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It's 5:42. Thanks for listening to KAXE and the Friday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. Our weather for today: sunny, temperatures in the upper 60s to mid 70s, winds from the southeast 5 to 10, gusting up to 15, and temps tonight 50 to 55. For tomorrow, sunny, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s, and for Sunday, sunny, highs in the mid 70s. You can help shape the future of our cultural programming by taking a survey on our legacy shows. You can find a link at kaxc.org. Heartland Arts presents the Park Rapids Art Leap tomorrow from 10 to 5 and Sunday from 11 to 4. Travel to 31 sites to explore a variety of artistic expression. Find guides at the Park Rapids Area Library or online at heartlandarts.org. You can let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. Beltrami County Historical Society in Bemidji hosts an author reading tomorrow evening, 6 o'clock. Hear readings from the new edition of North Country Journal, which features stories of remarkable Beltrami County women. Itasca County Public Health offers a flu vaccine clinic on Thursday, October 2nd from 4 to 6 at the Itasca Resource Center in Grand Rapids for those with and without insurance. No appointments are necessary. There is more ahead from Morning Edition on People Powered KAXE.
KAXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
For NPR comes from this station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. It's the final weekend of Major League Baseball's regular season, and with only three games to go, some postseason questions still need answers. So to look ahead, we've called Chelsea Janes. She's the national baseball writer at the Washington Post. Chelsea, let's start with the American League Central Division. The Tigers have been in first place pretty much the entire season and in control, but now Cleveland has caught them. What happened?
Many things happened. This would be the biggest collapse, I think, in baseball history, with a team that built a lead that big and lost it. So a lot went wrong. The main thing that went wrong is they stopped being able to pitch well. This is a team that had a comeback much like Cleveland's last year at this time. They were the magic team, the dolls of the league. And this year, they just didn't have the pitching. Everyone who was good last year got hurt. And they've just haven't been able to recover. So they have three games now to try to forestall what would be the biggest collapse, basically, of the modern baseball era.
Yeah, the Tigers are in Boston this weekend. The Guardians host the Texas Rangers. And Houston is one game back of the Tigers in the AL wildcard race. So the Tigers could completely miss the postseason. How unbelievable would that be?
It would be unthinkable, truly, and something that I think would be a part of their history for a very long time and freshen their minds for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Okay. American League East, the Toronto Blue Jays and the New York Yankees, they're tied for first right now. Does it matter which one of those teams winds up in first?
It does. I think the Blue Jays need for their minds and the minds of their fans to hold on to that lead. It secures them a bye, so they wouldn't have to play a quick first-round series where anything can happen. But they're a team that has fought and looked like they could win that division for many years. They haven't done it the last few. So to hold on, or better put, to lose it now, I think would be pretty devastating to them. That's a team that needs confidence, and I think holding on these last 3 days would go a long way in reminding them that they belong here.
And I'm sure MLB would love to have the Yankees on TV as often as possible playing a first-round series. Right, yeah, there you go.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, so the National League, the division races are settled. It's the Dodgers, Phillies, and Brewers. But the wild card, the last wild card spot, three-team battle. It's the Mets, Reds, and Diamondbacks. Who's got the best chance to get in?
The Mets should have the best chance to get in. They've spent a historic amount on this roster, over $300 million, near $350 million. They've got talent. They've got Hall of Famers. So really, they shouldn't be here at all. So they should make it. But that's not how baseball works. So the Reds are a team that's been not playing very well, but they're hanging around. And the Diamondbacks have a little bit of momentum. I think the Mets have the most talent, but they're for some reason here, and they're really anxious. So that always plays in and makes it harder to kind of finish things off.
So who do you think will be squaring off in the World Series? And part of the correct answer is the Dodgers.
The Dodgers are hard to bet against. They're a little beat up right now. They don't have the bullpen they had that helped them last year. I think the Phillies are probably the most well-rounded team. And if I had to pick a team in the American League, I think the Seattle Mariners have some really good feel to them, a really good, well-rounded roster. But I think the Dodgers and the Phillies are by far the best teams, and it'll just depend on which one beats the other in the first round, unfortunately.
Mariners are a very good choice, Chelsea, because they do have the pitching, and if they are at home, that's a pitcher's ballpark, so they can make a deep, deep run. Really Absolutely. Quick, I want to just quickly, a few seconds, the next year, robot umpires will be making some calls. What do you think that's going to look like?
I think it's going to be a change that we think a lot about at the beginning and then forget about by the end, but I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
All right, that's Chelsea Janes, national baseball writer from the Washington Post. Chelsea, thanks.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
In the past, we knew more about our neighbors. I'm Heidi Holton, and KEXE provides that. We get to know the people that live in northern Minnesota, like Kathy Davies on What's for Breakfast.
Well, truly, every day I wake up with you guys, and so there's socialization. And I love the local news. That interview with Amy Klobuchar this morning was wonderful. I am so supportive of finding out what's going on with all the tribal stations, and I care about the Canadian wildfires. I love to hear about everything that's local. You know, I've been to Riverfest, and that was fantastic. I listen to and support KAXE because you guys are what it's all about up here.
When you donate to KEXE, you're supporting your local community. Help us out now during this crisis of the defunding of public media from the federal government. Thank you for being there for KEXE. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
If you use medicine, sit on furniture, or get stuff delivered by truck, take note of new Trump administration import taxes.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Avalara, providing cloud-based solutions for businesses to manage property tax compliance. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. President Trump has unveiled a new batch of tariffs to start the 1st of October. Medicine, heavy trucks, and household furniture. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer is following this.
In a social media post, President Trump says the U.S. will impose a 100% tariff on imports of any branded or patented pharmaceutical product. There will be an exception for companies that are building plants in the U.S. That is, Trump says, if they've broken ground or a project is under construction. The impact of this import tax isn't clear, though, since according to the FDA, about 90% of all U.S. prescriptions are filled with generic drugs, which won't be affected by the new tariff. Trump also announced a 50% duty on cabinets, a 30% import tax on upholstered furniture, and a 25% tariff on imports of heavy trucks. All these new duties start October 1st. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
We're talking here 4 days, 17 hours until a partial federal government shutdown is possible. Services deemed essential would keep going, but federal workers wouldn't get paid until the budget impasse is resolved. A shutdown will especially shake the sixth largest metro area in the U.S., the National Capital Region that includes Washington, D.C., home. It's a metro that's home to more than 6 million people. Marketplace's senior Washington correspondent Kimberly Adams reports.
Between the DOGE layoffs and cuts to federal grants and research, unemployment here in the D.C. area is up 0.6% year over year as of June.
While in very large metro areas as a whole in the country, it's basically flat.
Tracy Haddon Lowe is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and has been tracking the impact of Trump administration policies in the region. She says the housing market has taken a hit as well, with listings up more than 63% in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area.
They're up nationwide, but the increase in the DMV is about double the nationwide rate.
Tourism is also suffering, says Yesham Sayan, executive director of the D.C. Policy Center.
There's no interest among European tourists to come to the district. Canadian tourists who have been important, they're not coming for political reasons.
And now already stressed federal workers are worried about a shutdown as well. Furloughed federal workers are supposed to get back pay, but says Terry Clower at George Mason University.
That doesn't help the folks who are working at the restaurants or places that may be retail outlets.
or some federal contractors who lose out on work and just have to take the hit. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
A star of the pandemic, the used car chain CarMax, is coming off a lackluster quarter. Only part of it was car buying in the late winter to get ahead of expected tariffs in the spring. CarMax stock fell 20% yesterday. This morning, Dow futures are up 0.1%. S&P futures are flat, and NASDAQ futures are down 0.2% ahead of a closely watched inflation report this morning. Personal consumption expenditures, the core rate, excluding food and fuel, is the one that central bankers watch. It's supposed to ease slightly. By that measure, prices are up 2.9% in a year at last check.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. The Name Your Price tool provides a range of coverage options. Progressive.com. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at Schwab.com.
You may not have heard of a company called Tricolor, but its bankruptcy this month is seen as a harbinger of wider economic distress. The Texas-based firm specialized in car and truck loans to buyers with poor credit or no credit, some of whom are in the U.S. illegally. It's part of the $80 billion subprime auto market. Marketplace's Henry Epp looks at some of the reasons buyers have racked up a lot of car loan debt in recent years.
Over the past few years, cars and trucks got way more expensive. Jessica Caldwell is with the car buying site Edmunds.
Pre-pandemic versus now, they've gone up significantly.
29%, according to Cox Automotive. The average price of a new car is over $49,000 now. That means buyers are taking on more debt. Joelle Scally is an economic policy advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
The average auto loan borrower in the U.S., owes about $5,000 more than they did in 2019. And what's interesting about that is that's not just for borrowers with the highest credit score.
Subprime borrowers have seen their loans grow a similar amount, Scally says. Typically, those are lower income borrowers, she says, and that means their car loans are a bigger burden on their budgets.
There's going to be a higher payment on those loans, in part due to the higher balance, but also because rates are higher now.
Over 7% for new cars and 11% or more for used vehicles, according to Edmunds. At the same time, says Shannon Martin at Bankrate, lenders recognize many consumers are stretched thin, so they've made it easier for some customers with lower credit scores to get loans.
There's been offers extended of, you know, longer loan periods, lower down payments.
Locking some borrowers into loans stretching to 7 years in some cases.
That also kind of puts consumers in a very precarious situation where if it's hard for you to make those payments, you're locked in for a much longer time than you would have been over the past few years.
Access to subprime financing may get a bit trickier after the collapse of the lender Tricolor for two reasons. One, Tricolor, like most auto lenders, had its own lines of credit with banks, which are now facing losses. So, says Adam Levitin at Georgetown Law, we may see banks
being more circumspect about the advances they make to subprime auto lenders.
Plus, lenders typically bundle up all the auto loans they extend to borrowers into what are known as asset-backed securities. Sound familiar? And if those securities now look a bit riskier to investors,
we may see less investor demand for those. That's going to basically push up the cost of subprime auto credit,
which could make it that much harder for some drivers to buy cars. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Our executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our digital team includes Antoinette Brock, Emily McCune, and Dylan Mietinen. Our engineers are Brian Allison, Rachel Breeze, and Tessa Block. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. There is more ahead for Morning Edition and the Friday Morning Show. John Bauer and Heidi Holton, your hosts. Coming up at 6:45, our Talk Back segment. It's always great to hear from our listeners. Text in your thoughts about what you hear, 218-326-1234. Our weather for today, sunny with temperatures in the upper 60s to mid-70s, southeast winds 5 to 10, gusting higher. Our lows tonight, 50 to 55, and tomorrow, sunny, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s, and warmer on Sunday with highs in the mid-70s. Thank you for choosing KAXE this morning. There is more ahead from Morning Edition.
Good morning. Prosecutors obtained an indictment of